And welcome to the Data Protection Made Easy podcast, tailored to the education sector. Today, we had a very special guest and a very special colleague of ours supporting a talk around data protection in the education sector. And I'm pleased to invite her back for this intro session. So welcome, Vicky.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
And as usual, and his very much appreciated support, we've got producer Miles.
Hello, Dave. Hello, Dave. Great session today.
Yes, I thought it was as well. I was. I've not worked in the education sector, so it gave me a chance to ask Vicky and those that joined in around some of the areas that they were facing, some of the problem areas that they may have been facing within the education sector. In that sense, and it was good to see many within the community joining in and asking questions. I hope I caught them all. But what stood out for you particularly from the session, Vicky?
There was a lot of interaction, which was great. A lot of people who seemed to be experiencing the same sort of questions and issues that I was. It's very much the same thing in every school or college or sixth form college across the country. The same issues being raised. And it was really interesting just to get their insight and to come together with other people who does that role in schools and colleges and get their take on things and find out how they're doing things. And I know some of the listeners found it really useful. They asked some questions and got some answers from other colleagues as well, which was great.
For sure. One thing that really kind of stuck out for me is kind of when we started the session by looking at resourcing and funding of DP and being able to ensure that schools and colleges have appropriate resources, time, money, people, experience, knowledge, that kind of thing in making sure that data protection is done well and done to the right standard. But one thing that seemed to be missing, and I think this echoes your background slightly there, Vicky, was some free resources and collaborative groups or areas where you can just reach out to other DPOs and other compliance professionals within the education sector to kind of for a kind of free support for peer-to-peer kind of questions and bits and pieces. And that kind of really shone out to me it did, at least. I might be looking in the wrong areas, but that kind of really shone out as a need. Would you kind of agree with that there's this, it kind of have a community of education DPOs, for example?
Yes, absolutely. One thing that I found as working as a DPO in a school was that I didn't have anyone to talk to. We had the support of DPP, and I could have, you know, paid for your time to ask for your question, but sometimes I didn't want to. I just wanted to ask some advice or how are you approaching this? You know, what does this policy document look like for you? Are you using this EdTech provider, and what have you found with their due diligence? And just general questions and support from other people doing the same job in other schools would have been really useful for me. And I searched, and if there is any out there, then I didn't find them, but it was something that I felt was missing and much needed, especially because the guidance that comes out to schools from you know, people like the ICO is very minimal and is very vague, and we have to navigate this using our own judgment. So it would have been useful to have other people there with me.
No, and I echo that as well. I've not worked in the education sector, but I echo that from having just a sounding board at times. You don't necessarily need kind of consultancy advice or legal advice over a particular technical point, but it's just, well, how have you done this? You know what I mean? In that sense, and just that kind of sounding board, not necessarily, like I say, from technical advice in such senses. So I got that. The other bit that I kind of really took from it is actually, and this is probably going to show a bit of my naivety, really, but I've never worked in the education sector, is just how much information you are actually processing.
Yeah, it's phenomenal. There's such a huge amount. You can't, unless you work in a school, you can't really get your head around it. The amount of data that's generated every day in a school and trying to keep track of it, trying to map it. You know, when GDPR came along and we were told that we need to do a data mapping exercise and find all the data, it just took so long to find it all. And then to, you know, to write your privacy notices and to format a retention schedule and everything like that, it was massive, absolutely huge.
For sure. And it kind of brings it together, because there were quite a few overlaps that I could draw analogies from other sectors. So there's some kind of common themes coming through from the education sector into other sectors that I've worked in. But it's certainly useful listening to you. And I think we'd probably best leave it there. I think those that are listening to the podcasts and the intro sessions may well be teaching with anticipation as to the areas that were covered, and are more than happy to let them go into the next session. Just a bit of a recap, next week's our final week before we wrap things up for Christmas. So next week's session, we're wrapping up 2022 and having a look at some of the top was it the top podcasts, Miles, that we've and the top topics that's had the most listens to in the series that we've run this year.
Well, if any of the listeners check our LinkedIn, we did a Spotify Wrapped for the end of the year, which showed our most viewed episodes on Spotify. So there were five topics that really jumped out for us on in that list of our most viewed episodes. So yeah, we wanted to take a look back at 2022, see what those five episodes were, and discuss why they were so popular, really.
For sure, and I'm certainly looking forward to wrapping up 2022 next week and to cover off those areas. If you can't join us next week live, then we will always, as usual, push the podcast out and all the good and common areas that you can pick our podcasts up from. If you're not going to join us live next week because of leave, because of work, because of some other commitments, then on behalf of DPP, myself, Vicky, and producer Miles, we hope you have a great Christmas and New Year. Thank you very much for helping us make the series. Thank you very much for continuing to joining and support the series and listen to the topics that we cover off. We do welcome you next year to a mute to raise topics, any areas of interest that you'd like the team to discuss and to kick around at one of the sessions or a specific session. Please do let us know by getting in touch with producer Miles or anybody within the team, and we'll look forward to covering those off. But from the time being, I will sign off. I will let you jump into the podcast session, and I'll bid you farewell for now. Have a great weekend. Today's GDPR radio session. It's a podcast today on education and challenges that schools may face around data protection. So we're going to take you through some areas that we hope that might be interesting. This is your session as much as very much our session. We are trying to build a community of individuals. Please feel free at any point to use the chat function to put your thoughts and comments in the chat function, or if you're feeling brave enough and you want to unmute and join in, then please do so. I'm sure we will welcome anybody and their thoughts and comments to unmute and join in whenever you feel. I would like to introduce, as part of this session, as we get started, one of my colleagues who's experienced and used to work within the education sector. So we'll welcome Vicky. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dave. Great to be here.
Would you like to just do a little introduction to yourself before we get into the nitty gritty, shall we say, and before we really start progressing the podcast on the education side of things, just to kind of give a little bit of your background, as it were?
Yeah, no problem. So I have come to DPP after working as a DPO in a large independent school in Leeds. I was there for 7 years, and the first five of those I was actually the data manager. So I managed all the data that flowed around the school. I managed their sort of main database and advice on all sorts of data projects. And then 5 years in, they asked me if I wanted to take on the role of DPO as well. And so at that point, I had no knowledge of data protection. I went off and did two exams from the IAPP within the first year, and then acted as their DPO for subsequent further 2 years. And now I have joined DPP as a consultant.
Good stuff, and it's certainly lovely to have you on board with us, and we've certainly had some really great feedback since you've joined us, so welcome. So today we're going to be looking at, normally the podcast series, we look a little bit about the news and the views from a GDPR radio series, but these are some of the kind of the more specific focus areas, and today we are looking around education. So the news and views, if we get time, we'll funnel in at the end. But as any keen listener will know, we do tend to cover a lot of topics and a lot of ground in the hour that we have. If we don't get time for the news and views at the end of this session, then we'll add that to next week's podcast series and the GDPR radio series, and the final one of this year before we wind things back just for the Christmas period. So to start with, In the educational, well, data protection in the education arena, shall we say, and looking at some of the challenges that schools may have, or as the DPO within schools that you may have. Where shall we start then, Vicky? If I throw over to you, what would be one of your, if I had to kind of say, what's your kind of a top four, top five issues within the that you faced within your time within the education sector? Where would you like to start first?
Well, there's different things here. I mean, there's challenges that schools as a whole face, and then I want to cover a few challenges that I personally faced doing my role. But the biggest one, I think, is around funding for data protection in schools. I think there's a lack of funding. There's a lack of money being put into resources around data protection. And I don't think that's the school's fault in any way. I just think that's you know, the times that we're in at the moment. Schools have got small budgets and they can't afford to spend, you know, thousands of pounds every year on professional guidance. So there's lots of different avenues out there for help. There's, you know, one-man band type consultants, there's companies like us. And there might be some schools out there that are doing it on their own and just trying to muddle through. But I do think one of the big problems is money around data protection.
And appropriate resources in people, knowledge, experience and tools in order to manage DP. I'm guessing not just from kind of information governance frameworks, but as we've seen and you've seen within your role as well, where they were looking at tech for supporting data protection and using some software, or whether you've just actually got the tools available in order to manage correctly, I guess, is the areas that we're looking at there.
Yeah, exactly. If you talk about tech, you know, the school spends a lot of money on tech and software for people learning and databases to hold all sorts of information, but trying to get some sort of compliance software is an upward battle, if I'm honest, trying to get some money put in so that I could actually have some software to record everything that I needed to record under data protection laws. So there is very much a sort of money is spent where it needs to be spent in terms of teaching, which is very rightly so. It's a struggle to get money to be spent anywhere else, including data protection.
No, for sure. And I guess it's kind of a matter related to kind of funding and resources. And this is partly reflecting also in my time prior to consultancy when I was working in-house with DP, where sometimes it would feel an awfully lonely and kind of isolated place where you may be within an organisation not getting a lot of traction and bits and pieces, or you maybe just need a bit of a sense check of areas that you're working on, and you're not quite sure which direction you take things in and that kind of thing. Do you find that there's a common resource between either schools or within the education sector for DPOs to share ideas and share concerns? And I'm raising that knowing that we've that you're kind of championing a kind of an educational sector focus within LinkedIn within a DPP group, but prior to you implementing that with DPP, was there something that you could call upon in that sense?
No, not that I found. If it is out there, then I didn't find it. But regularly, I didn't necessarily want to pay for professional advice. I just wanted to have a chat with somebody else in that role in another school, who I could say, "Oh, have you used this processor? You know, what did you think of them? They're really, really funny with me. I just want to, you know, have a chat with somebody about it." And I didn't find that resource there at all.
For sure.
So that's why the first thing that I did when I joined DPP was wanting to set up some sort of forum for DPOs within schools to talk to each other and to share ideas and just to ask, you know, silly questions, really, because I didn't have anyone to go to. And quite often, whenever I posed a question to our SLT or posed a new idea, a new thing that I wanted to implement, quite often the response was, "Well, is this how other schools are doing it?" And I had no answer for that. I don't know how other schools are doing it because I have no contacts in other schools. But this is how I recommend we do it. And sometimes that was enough, sometimes it wasn't enough.
For sure, for sure. And I think that's really important because there are some really good resources out there. Some of them cost more than others, whether it's technology, whether it's consultancy advice through a range of organisations from one-man bands or very small kind of consultancy teams through to larger organisations that can offer the same service. But it's probably a different level and a different different fee level. But a little bit around self-help, isn't it, with regards to those kind of groups where you can come and share ideas, share knowledge, pool concepts, that kind of thing. So if you're struggling with producing ropers, or you're not quite sure, as you mentioned there, with a provider that you're trying to run through some form of debt protection due diligence and measures or areas that you're getting stuck with in that sense, and just having that pooled kind of a resource to draw on of like-minded individuals all within the similar sector.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So I'm looking forward to that group taking off. I think it's certainly extremely valuable. I've been part of similar groups in different walks of life in relation to not just data protection, but in relation to other roles that I had, especially around direct marketing and within particular sectors. And that kind of knowledge sharing, what worked and what hasn't worked, is that the kind of really practical advice around some of the topics undoubtedly benefited my role and benefited the organisation as a consequence of that, and possibly through sharing ideas benefited others as well. So we've looked at funding as being an issue there with small budgets, restricted budgets, and especially nowadays, unfortunately, with the cost of living crisis, and we just seem to be hearing all the time that costs are going up, and the cost of running schools or cost of running other organisations through gas and electric and bits is we're having bigger draws on budgets and so on and so forth, that kind of thing. Do you think the funding issue will be greater or more exacerbated, shall we say, depending whether you're at a state school, a MATS, or an independent school, or do you think they're all in a very similar position from a resourcing point around debt protection compliance?
I think they're all in a similar position, really. I mean, state schools are struggling with rising costs, as you say, and the same amount of money coming from the government, and then independent schools are fighting for, you know, for pupils and for money, and people can't afford to pay for that anymore, and so moving into the state sector. So it's a sector-wide issue, I think. And another challenge, which sort of touches on nicely to this, is around accountability and the fact that Ofsted and ISI don't really take any interest in data protection as it currently stands, and because of that, schools are putting their money elsewhere. They're putting their money into areas where the inspections are going to cover, and data protection is very much a second thought, in my experience, because, you know, times are tough and they spend the money where they have to spend the money.
For sure, for sure. And that's really interesting around the Ofsted element of it. I've just noticed a couple of points in the chat, and we'll come to that shortly. But the Ofsted and ISI, how would we get Ofsted and ISI kind of more interested or more turned on? Because I'm assuming if, let's say, debt protection compliance or privacy issues were within the assessment framework by Ofsted, then schools and colleges and those caught by the Ofsted inspections may well give greater focus to privacy and compliance matters.
I think they absolutely would, and I think the only way that you can get them to include that in the inspection is by lobbying the government to include that, because I don't think it's Ofsted or ISI that decide what it is that they're inspecting.
So in essence, Ofsted just polices the standard. They don't necessarily write the standard in that sense.
Exactly. Yes.
But it's only interesting to because what would, and it's only anecdotal from my points as well, but some of the clients that I work with that have got better compliance programs in place, shall we say, are ones that are often policed through different regulators, or at least have an influence by different regulators, ensuring that they comply with all relevant laws. And so on and so forth. So it's certainly interesting to see other regulators doing their bit. Again, anecdotally, we're also seeing compliance being driven through the supply chain, and organisations are now approaching us saying that they need to have certain measures in place in order to compete, in order to win business and that kind of thing. So you've certainly got a supply chain pull. And it's also often interesting to see that some of the progression around compliance in data protection information security is led through additional standards or complementary standards from different regulators. Yeah. So it's certainly been an interesting point from an educational point would be whether Ofsted would be the body to do that and that kind of thing, or whether there's a different kind of body that might get kind of compliance moving in that sense.
Yeah, potentially. Sorry. I was going to say it's sort of similarly to the housing sector, having something in there that says that you must comply with all relevant laws, you know, might catch it. But for me, you know, safeguarding laws are such a massive part of inspections. And I personally think the data protection law sits sort of intertwined with safeguarding law, because yes, you're safeguarding the child, and it's very important that you do that, but also you need to safeguard their data, because any breach of data can have such huge consequences on children and their futures, in the same way that a safeguarding breach can. So I think it's just as important that they check on both areas.
No, for sure. And there's quite a lot of overlap between kind of the schools and kind of similar problems we've seen in different sectors. And we'll maybe draw on some of those shortly. I just want to pick up on a couple of comments just within the chat functions that have been raised. So I am trying to get better at this. Ollie was really good at keeping his eye on the chats when he was still with us. So if you are listening in, Ollie, we would certainly welcome you back for the podcast series. It's making my life a little bit harder. I am getting used to it, and I am trying to remember to pick in there. So Sarah's asked whether the session is just about schools and data protection, as she works in a sixth form college, and data protection is slightly different because of the age range. Again, it's open to the education sector, and we can consider elements within higher education and sixth form college. If you've got any particular queries or questions or points you'd like to raise, Sarah, please feel free to drop them in the chat, or if you'd like to unmute and to join in, myself and Vicky would certainly welcome you to do so. So yes, please feel free, and that's a query open to everybody. Ben, on the other hand, has said that the GDPR isn't the remit for Ofsted, and arguably it shouldn't be, because you're then crossing functions of the regulator. I do get that approach with crossing functions of the regulator, Ben, but I've certainly seen it in other areas, as we say, with the social housing sector side of things, under particular governance standards by that regulator. There are obligations to comply with all relevant law and reporting functions back to that regulator that identifies that you do so. So it's not necessarily policed by them, but there's certainly an obligation to inform whether you do comply with all relevant law, that kind of thing. And as a consequence, the focus is greater on that. So thank you very much for the comments there. Did you want to pop in and say something, Sarah? I just see that you're there's a little blue circle around your name there.
Hello. Thanks very much for the opportunity. We very often get parents who email in wanting information about their son or daughter, and it's usually where there's an estranged relationship with the parents. And our stance is that it's down to the student as to whether permission can be given to share information with that estranged parent. I just want to make sure that I am following the right route doing that, because our students invariably are aged from 16 through to occasionally 19. Obviously, when they're over 18, it definitely is down to them whether their information is shared or not.
For sure. Very good question. Ben, I've just seen your chat saying, can you come in this? You're more than welcome to come in this, and Ben as well, if you'd like to unmute.
Thank you. I'm also working in further education sector, and I think Sarah's point about whether, while we're looking at the education sector as a whole and there is a lot of overlap, equally there are significant differences between a school-based provision and a further education or higher education, partially due to the age of the learner, but also how education law impacts the different types of organisations and how we're structured and legally recognised. And I think Sarah's particular question around what we can share with parents is one of those examples. The other element being, it will vary depending on where that sixth form college is based. So Scotland has slightly different rules. But we, to give you confidence, Sarah, we work on exactly the same principle as yourselves. For our students, they are old enough to determine who has access to their data and what information is shared. And unless it is a safeguarding obligation and covered by that safeguarding lawful basis, we work on the basis of asking our students for consent. We ask them at the beginning of the year, are you happy for us to discuss your performance and progress at college with other individuals? And if so, to name those individuals, and they could be parents, foster parents, other family members. And unless there is an alternate lawful basis or there is a legal obligation, for example, sharing data with social workers, within councils, etc., generally day-to-day information sharing with family is done purely on consent. And if we don't have that consent, then we say to the parents, sorry, we are unable to share this information. But equally, I think the other thing is not to alienate in that messaging, and to still be able to take comment from the parents, still allow them to inform the educational journey and any concerns they have at home, and still being able to bring that in together.
I think it's a really valuable point that you both raised, and thank you for doing so. Have you got any thoughts on that, Vicky? Without necessarily jumping straight over to you.
No, in my opinion, I think what they're doing is absolutely right. The school that I came from had a sixth form, and we took the stance that anybody who was in sixth form, it would be their consent, and it would be them that needed to request the subject access request if that's what was going on. So I think what they're doing is absolutely right. There is, I know that sixth form colleges and colleges are not subject to the education regulation, because that's just for state schools, so they can't come under the sort of disclosure of information to parents under that law. So in that case, the only thing open to students or parents to access information would be under the GDPR and as a subject access request. But as we know, that is a subject access request that needs to come from the data subject, and when they're old enough to make that decision themselves, then it's them that needs to make it, or it's them that needs to provide the consent for their parents to make it on their behalf.
Sure, and I think it's possibly going to be a bit of a moot point as well, and it'd be certainly one that I'm interested to see if anybody else got an idea on as well. So I'll just pose the question, which is, when we're looking at subject access requests within schools, colleges, that kind of thing, what is the age of consent when we're looking at? Is the law clear on the age of consent around that? There may well be the laws and educational bits and pieces around that may have an influence on that, and by all means I'm happy to hear about those as well. But is there an age to consent under DSARS where children are, let's say, under the age of 18? We've certainly had from heard from Sarah and Ben about children in kind of sixth form being 16 to 19. So where do we feel that the age of consent sits?
So interestingly, just before this session, I had a look on the ICO's website about guidance that they've released for accessing people's information. And it says on there, and I quote, if you have parental authority and the child is under 12 years of age, you can request copies of their personal data. So the ICO has seemed to be taking the stance that it's 12. However, what we took in my old role was the stance that it was all about guilt competency. So if the child was understood the request of what was going on, and we were confident that they understood it, then we would ask them for their consent. If they were young enough that we didn't think that they would fully understand what their parents were asking for or what was going on, then we would ask the parents in that situation. So I know 12 isn't actually written in the law, it's just ICO guidance, but that seems to be the sense that they're going down. But I think in practice, you've got to satisfy yourself that the child is guilt competent.
For sure. For sure. It's really an interesting one, isn't it? Because if you look at the laws, just data protection laws, I'm not looking at other laws around this, but just data protection laws, they're not necessarily clear on age of consent and when you can provide consent in that sense. So ICO's guidance would indicate that a child is under the age of 18. If you're looking at ADCOP, or the Age Appropriate Design Code of Practice, you're looking at that as currently set in the UK as kind of 13 upwards, I think it is. So there's some ages, but it's not necessarily directly related to consent in that sense. You've mentioned there about kind of the GILLIT competencies and so on and so forth. Ben's just raised his hand again. We'd like to come in again, Ben.
Yeah, I was just going to say, I think part of the reason why there isn't an age necessarily listed. I mean, GDPR puts age of consent at 12, and under member state law that can be lowered, but it's all about the competency of that individual, and because different people will mature at different rates and they'll have that understanding at different rates, I think it would be wrong for legislation or even guidance to state an age. But it's about when that individual can clearly communicate to you what it is they're trying to achieve and what they're looking to get, and that they understand that full process. And I think that's for colleges, universities, I think that's slightly more clear cut. But maybe with schools, when you've got that younger age group, that's where it could then be appropriate, as per that ICO guidance, to have that parental involvement, depending on the competency of that child and how they can communicate their wishes.
For sure. So what we're saying is it's not necessarily a blanket approach. It's not necessarily that kind of baseline age clearly stipulated in the law, because it's going to be rather subjective based on various factors. I think that's possibly where we've got to with that one. Certainly very good points, and I agree with everything that you've indicated there, Ben. By all means, if anybody wants to, anybody else wants to unmute and jump in, please feel free to do so. Were you going to say something else there, Vicky?
No,
on that point. So because we've touched on kind of information requests and kind of looked at the age, just moving away slightly from age at this moment in time, have you seen anything interesting from a DSAR point in the schools? Are they or subject access requests, are they let's say, for example, I've not necessarily worked directly with the schools, but under COVID conditions, when exams were replaced by teacher assessments, in that sense, there was this kind of feeling that there'd be this influx of DSARs from parents, possibly trying to understand the decision making that was applied by the schools or by the tutors involved as to how grades were formulated in that sense. Did you actually see that come through in your time within the schools?
No, we didn't. So I heard all of that anticipation as well for all the SARs that were going to come our way, and attended multiple webinars from law firms and other advisors about how to handle the influx of SARs that we're going to have. And then the exam results came and nothing happened. We didn't get a single subject access request, which was great, because, you know, there was just me doing the role and I didn't want to, you know, have, you know, multiple SARs to be doing at once. But no, we didn't get any, and I don't know what the reason for that is. I suspect it might be that the grades were inflated slightly because of how they were given. I know certainly in my previous school, they seemed to be higher compared to what we had for the few years before that. But maybe that means that the students and the parents are happy with them and that they don't want to challenge them. And if anything is higher than they expect it to be, they're not going to stick in a subject access request and challenge that. They're just going to accept the grade. But in general, for subject access requests, we used to get probably about 3 a year, not very many at all. And mostly those were as a result of complaints to the school, either because of how the school had acted in a certain situation or acted towards their child, or complaints against, I don't know, bullying going on, or another family that's, you know, not being very nice to them, that sort of situation that we were getting dragged into. So it's all generally around complaints of some sort, which is what we saw.
For sure. And we've certainly got some examples from kind of other sectors where subject access requests are probably more prolific in that sense. I was just interested in just trying to draw comparisons as well. There's a couple of more chat comments in the chat that I'll come to shortly. But with some of the sectors that I've worked with, you regularly get kind of subject access requests in relation to things like antisocial behaviour between tenants within a social housing sector, for example. And I just wondered whether, possibly not the skills, maybe more at colleges, possibly whether there's those elements kind of not necessarily, let's not call it antisocial behaviour in school, but let's say there's a parent perceived a child to be bullied or being having some kind of negative time at the school, and whether there's any trying to access information or comments that was made by the children within the school, that kind of thing. I was just interested to see whether that there's been a great kind of influx of information around those areas as well. But you've indicated within your school that you only had three, so perhaps not. And again, just kind of come to the audience as if anybody else has had kind of an experience from a high number of subject access requests or generally what may be kind of the leaders to or the root cause of where subject access requests come from.
Yeah.
Just moving just to a couple of comments in the chat. So we've got Mrs. Lane suggests we've had a subject access request from an ex-pupil, completed it yesterday, but today they've received a couple more from friends of the ex-pupil, and it feels like they're a nuisance requests. And do we have any experience, or does anybody listening in from the sector have any experience or advice on this? So have you seen something similar in your own role there, Vicky?
No, actually, I haven't. Every SAR that I've had to deal with has just been a single one. We've had it where the same people have come back repeatedly saying, oh, we think you've got more stuff that you haven't disclosed. But we haven't had an influx like this of different people who are all sort of friends, unfortunately.
For sure. No, for sure. We'll come back to Ben. Ben's raised his hand. Would you like to come in on this one, Ben?
Thank you. Sorry, don't mean to keep coming back.
No, by all means, it's an open discussion, so by all means.
Yeah. So for myself, it's a further education college. We've now got 10 colleges and about 40,000 students per year. So we're much larger in comparison, I suppose. But we recently went through a merger, so we're about half that size before, and we were getting about 17 to 20 what are called traditional subject access requests each year. Traditional in the sense that on top of that you would then have your request from law enforcement agencies and local councils and other official authorities, etc., on top of that. So these were your traditional DSARs, give me access to everything, or I'm after X, Y, and Z. And there is always that variety. There's a variety of reasons why you get those requests. So some of them, if we're looking at students, it might be because there's an ongoing complaint or challenge. There's something they're not happy with, and therefore subject access request is a route to better understand the situation. If I think also when you go through any sort of a consultancy period with staff, that might generate a need or a desire for people to then put in requests for their data. If there's any sort of HR case, then often you would get requests from staff members subsequent to that to understand what's in their files. We've also had requests come in from parents historically, and that depending on how involved maybe they've been with a complaint or a challenge over gradings, they might be interested from that perspective. Or if they just suspect that there's some sort of vendetta or something along those lines, often there never is, but if they've got it in their mind that maybe their child is being disproportionately treated, they might then start to wonder what sort of notes are being kept on the parents, and this is where we start going through email chains and elements like that. I think just commenting on Ms. Lane's question, because the requests have come from different people, I would be inclined to treat them as subject access requests unless you can really clearly state that they are vexatious or something along those lines. But I think if they are the first requests from those individuals and it is a genuine subject access request which meets all those boxes, I would be inclined to just process it. You've got to be really clear as to why you would think otherwise and the fact that it hasn't come from that same individual. I've seen similar with freedom of information, where we believe you've got several individuals trying to process freedom of information around the same case, and often we can then provide one response to all of those. But it's a really tricky ground to stand on in terms of actually proving it and being confident in yourself.
For sure, and I would echo what you said there in relation to the advice to Mrs. Lane. I have certainly seen where the subject access requests have been used to frustrate an organisation through what would appear to be a concerted effort by a group of individuals. But as you've indicated quite well there, Ben, that you'd have to take on a case-by-case basis. You'd have to look at all of the facts around it, and you'd have to be absolutely sure that the evidence would stack up, that it's a concerted effort, unfortunately. In this case, and again, just following your comments there, Ben, I would certainly be looking at this present moment in time that you're probably going to have to deal with them as independent requests for information and not necessarily link them at this point, unfortunately. But I have, like I said, I've not come across it in the education sector or for clients that we have within the education sector. The majority of the clients I have are in a range of different sectors, and I've seen some bits there, and I've read about others as well. So there is that there as well. Just moving on to Sarah's request, could we possibly explain what a litigation friend is, please, and indicated that they've received a subject access request from a solicitor's firm with the father of a former student providing consent to share information as a litigation friend. Has anybody ever come across a litigation friend in this sense? Would somebody like I can pop back to you, Vicky, or anybody else who would like to try to take on this question?
Unfortunately, I've never come across it before, so I'm happy if anyone else wants to chip in here.
I haven't come across the term litigation friend, but I'm wondering if they are intending this to be someone acting on their behalf in the DSAR, and they're just giving authorisation to that individual to pursue all matters of whatever it is they're trying to pursue.
For sure. I've certainly come across the term litigation friend before, and it's somebody who can support you with litigation, not necessarily legal advice, but somebody who could be there as an individual that you could talk to in relation to how you're feeling and matters, or to have a kind of a second person there. Cynthia, you've got your hand up.
Sorry, on mute. Sorry, just to say, I come across it quite a lot in my area, but it's not education so much. It's more social care, where we get a lot of people acting as litigation friends for service users who have mental learning disabilities or mental health challenges, and people write in if they've had accidents or they want to pursue requests for information because they're pursuing a challenge, maybe against a health professional. So I see a lot of it more in that context. I haven't seen it in the education sector though.
For sure. So I think coming back to a very good point there, Cynthia, but coming back to what Ben and Ben was alluding to, I think if you treat it as a subject access request and then make sure that there's appropriate authorisation for it to be disclosed in that sense. In the case from Sarah here, if it's a request from a solicitor, I'd certainly be checking that you've got due authorisation to share it with a solicitor, and that the solicitor can demonstrate that, and whether that authorisation included sharing information with the father as well in that sense. But I have understood the term, and quite helpfully, and thank you, Robert, for doing so, there's a link to litigation friends from the Open Gov website. It's just been dropped in there for a link as well, so hopefully you'll find that of some use. So thank you very much there, everybody who contributed. By all means, Sarah, please do come back in.
Thank you. It's not something I've come across before. I very often get requests from solicitors firms because a student's been in a road traffic accident is the usual reason. and they're wanting copies of all educational records, obviously to use as evidence that perhaps this young person didn't perform as expected because of the accident. I've nothing from the student saying that they've given permission for father to be litigation friend. It's not something I'm familiar with. So can I have a copy of an authorisation form signed by the dad from the solicitors. So I feel a little bit uncomfortable proceeding with it at the moment because it's unfamiliar territory to me.
No, for sure. And just before we explore that one, Nadia's got your hand up as well. Nadia?
Hi there. So a lot of the times we get requests from legal representatives, and what we tend to do is if the request has come from the parent and the child's of an age, we'll also ask the child to confirm and provide their consent for us to provide all the information they're requesting, and for the parent and the legal representative to act on their behalf. So we also do both. So what that does is it covers you and makes sure that everyone is aware, everyone's got authorization, you've got the correct consent, and you can make a record of it. So that's how we tend to do it.
Okay, thank you very much then, Nadia. So coming back to you there, then Sarah, did you find it helpful in that sense? I think solicitors should be providing, I've certainly asked solicitors for authorisation from them, that their authorisation that they've received from their clients showing that they're entitled to make that request on their client's behalf. And if they don't supply it, then they should be providing that in that sense. So I hope you found that useful, and hopefully that authorisation would then cover litigation friend as well.
Your suggestion is that I go back to the solicitor's firm and ask for some sort of evidence that the student has given the father permission to be litigation friend.
I would ask for evidence from the solicitor that that's the case, yeah.
Okay, that's really helpful. Thank you.
I've done it before where we've had solicitors saying that they're representing a debtor subject and it's a civil claim, for example, but the solicitor's not included the authorisation. Just because they're acting on the individual's behalf doesn't mean that they've naturally then got the authorization to submit a subject access request on their behalf and for that information to be disclosed to their solicitor. Their client may well have bits of information that they don't want to disclose to their solicitor for whatever reason. It may not even be pertinent to the case, that kind of thing. So we always make sure that they've got due authorization from the client to disclose it to the solicitor before we disclose. And I've often gone back, and it normally relatively quick back from the solicitor, and we'll get that to you. Okay, so trying to move on then, because the time, as we often find on these things, generally creeps away. What other areas have you come across, Vicky, within the education sector, just to try and draw on some of the other areas that we may have come across? I can try and pitch a question for you, unless you've got something or some of the challenges that you may have come across.
No, the next one I was going to mention is around photographs and publicity. I used to get this question, you know, a couple of times a week, probably. Can I take photographs of my pupils? What can I do with the photographs? How long do I keep them for? Can I put it on social media? And it's just quite a minefield once you get into it of photographs of children. The way I'll explain how we used to do it in terms of publicity, we use the lawful basis of legitimate interest for publishing photographs and information about pupils onto our social media and our website. And it was to celebrate achievements of the pupils, or it might be to publicise the school in some way. But we use legitimate interest. And when a child joined the school, and we also refresh this every few years as well, they got a form which explained to them in as clear language as possible how what we're going to use the information for, and how they can object to or opt out of publicity. And then we also had on that form a consent mechanism for special category data use in publicity as well, because we used to send, so for example, GCSE results came out, we would then send a list of every Jewish student to a Jewish magazine, for example, and they would publish just the Jewish students' results. So for that case, we need a special category consent. So around that, we often found that parents were, well, I'd say every year about 10% of parents that got that form were filled it in incorrectly. So they'd either not filled it in at all, or they'd opt out of all publicity, but then consent to special category data, which doesn't make sense. And there was a big question around. We even reworded the form, so it was in basic English. And then it was, we sort of came to the question of, do they not understand this, or are they just not reading it? Are they getting so many forms from the school that they're just ticking every single box and sending it back? So there was big questions around photographs and publicity and what we can and can't do. And I think all schools come across that as well.
For sure, for sure. And it's a really interesting one, just to kind of pick up on a couple of points there, because you mentioned about using clear language, or as language that's clear and as clear as possible. And you're potentially referring to both the consent statement, or the information providing the opt out, at least if you're operating under legitimate interest, and also possibly wider privacy information. Firstly, and it would make me wonder whether who really focuses on the language that is used, and whether the language is audience specific as well. Firstly, are schools generally following, I guess, the core approach of a privacy notice just being in written English produced on the website, or whether the scrutiny of the words and the way it's phrased, whether there's white spaces around that, or even exploring different ways to provide privacy information through things like little cartoons or powtoons or video clips, that kind of thing, in order to try to make the privacy information, or even the consent statement or opt-out statement, as inclusive as possible to children with a range of different learning needs, for example.
Yeah. Just to pick up on Ben's point in the chat, he's put, we use consent and have a photo consent form which is granular in breaking down the different places their image will be used, for example social media, college website, print, etc. You absolutely can use consent, there's nothing wrong with that. We took the decision to not use consent just because we thought that was going to be too difficult to manage, specifically with the granular, because we had multiple staff members managing social media accounts, for example, and trying to make sure that a child that adopted into prospectus printing but then out of social media wasn't included on social media and out of prospectus, you know. So it just became a bit of a minefield, because there were so many different places that we could put information and photographs, and we saw breach written all over that, and took the decision to go down a legitimate interest route as well.
Very interesting. I've for my background in direct marketing, the very similar issue in relation to consent for case studies, or whether you don't use consent for case studies. So I can follow both arguments there in that sense, and certainly both validly used elements. If you're operating under a kind of legitimate interest there, do you actually ask them within the legitimate interest form, we are going to do this is where we are going to publish it, but is there a particular place that you don't necessarily want that disclosed? For example, we'd prefer not to have images on social media, that kind of thing.
We didn't on the form. It was just a straight opt out of everything, again, just because we thought that was going to be too difficult to try and manage across multiple staff members. But you can do that. That's another approach.
For sure, for sure. So it's certainly interesting. Have you had any kind of objections from parents? I'm assuming looking in at the wider sense, some parents may not want children's images being displayed on website or in marketing materials for a wide range of reasons, and we don't necessarily need to explore those reasons, but there may well be quite valid reasons why they don't want images disclosed and that kind of thing. And how do you manage that process? Because it's going to be it is kind of in essence an internal kind of suppression file, I guess.
Yeah.
That you use to run against any awareness raising campaigns that you might be looking for.
Yes, absolutely. So we logged that opt out on our main information management information system, which was SIMS, and then anybody who wanted to do anything had to run a report out of it, so it was up to date. We didn't download the list. It wasn't a list in Excel that was sat on SharePoint that could become out of date. It was live data, updated every day or every time somebody wanted to use the list, and then that acted as their as their sort of who to take out, essentially. But staff were really good at following it. We didn't have any problems. There's a wide range of reasons why parents, as you say, why parents don't want their children on social media. I personally am a parent of a 2-year-old, and I've taken the decision that I don't want my child to be on social media anywhere, just because I think that it's his right to have privacy in childhood, and I want him to be able to decide where and when he, you know, his picture and his information goes on the internet, not me, or not a school, or not his grandparents, or whoever. So there'll be other people out there that have got similar views, and likewise, I have seen a report recently which was done in the US, which looked at how much data is put on the internet by schools, and it was staggering, the amount of data that they found that originated in schools, and it's things just, again, really mundane images of a pupil doing an activity and something stuck on social media, but then they followed those images and that information as it went to different places, and they found it in some quite sort of dodgy websites as well. So schools should be aware of what they're putting on, you know, potentially limit the information that goes on so it's first name and not first name and second name, because that could track. The school that I worked in previously had a number of celebrity children as well, and so we didn't want that publicizing that that's where their school was. We didn't want media turning up and things like that. So there's a lot of considerations for schools to take with posting things on social media.
For sure, and with considerations comes kind of controls and safeguards in order to make sure the measures that are deemed to be appropriate are mindful of those measures that the school wish to police, whether it's around safeguarding, whether it's just around protecting children, celebrity children, and that kind of thing. But where there's controls and safeguards and those kind of measures, that there ought to be some kind of mechanism behind that. Ben's raised a couple of interesting points, so thank you very much again, Ben, for the chats there in the chat function. So another consideration needs to be whether any of the young people are looked after. Children, as you may also need permission from social workers, so a very valid point. And he's also further asked if you have a copy of the link that you just referred to there, Vicky, in relation to the stats from the US schools and what may happen with some of their images and that kind of thing, and certainly from the websites that you've you've indicated, it would suggest that schools, whether using materials for marketing purposes, need to be mindful of wider safeguarding concerns around that. So thank you very much, and thank you very much for dropping the chat in there. Time's marching on, so let's move on from photographs. I'm happy to come back to any of the points or to have any further discussions. If anybody's got any burning questions, please do either unmute or raise your hand or join in if there's any points. But if not, let's just swiftly move on to some other areas in data protections and the schools and that kind of thing. So let's pick an area that we often find problematic across a range of different clients. And I hope we don't get too many groans by mentioning this. But what's how have you found data retention managed within schools?
Very difficult is how to sum that up. Schools have such a huge amount of data. It's phenomenal what they've got. And trying to keep a track of that is very difficult. And trying to ensure that, I mean, firstly, trying to get a retention schedule in place is very hard because you've got to find all the data. You've got to find out what all the obligations are, you know, if there's any legal obligations to keep it for certain length, and there often is. You've got to find all that out. And then you've got to implement that, get that out to your staff, get them trained in what they're doing, and then police it as well and make sure that data that's in all those systems is actually deleted. And it is very, very difficult to do. Thinking about, you know, one area that I really struggled with was all of the edtech providers. You know, we had a processor list that was over 100 companies, trying to make sure that data was deleted out of every single one of those. Was really hard because they weren't all managed within the data department. You know, the geography department might decide that they want this little piece of educational resource software, which is brilliant, but they need to manage it. They need to upload the data into it, and they need to be responsible for making sure it comes out at the end of its life as well. So it was very hard. I don't have all of the answers, I'm afraid, as to how to do that. You just got to struggle through and do the best you can.
No, for sure. And I've certainly got a couple of comments on that, that again, drawn on my experiences of the clients as well. So some of the comments that I can kind of support you with that is sometimes it's not necessarily the fact that we know we can't retain stuff in an identifiable format for longer than is necessary. So therefore, are we looking at some form of anonymization, some form of pseudonymization, and or at the end of ultimately at the end of the retention period, at what point we're going to look at secure data destruction and so on. But sometimes the software hasn't developed quickly enough, and sometimes the organizations may find themselves between a bit of a rock and a hard place, between, well, we know we need to delete this some information, but the functionality within some of the systems that we use is either very convoluted or very difficult to manage and configure, or possibly if you're still using very old systems, whether you can actually set particular kind of retention periods and use the software to support you in that sense. So yeah. That's one of the areas that I've often found is problematic, is the software and the age of the software and so on and so forth. The other area I've often come across as well within some organisations is that there's not the strength of control, shall we say, around using of processes, or maybe not actually understanding that they are processes, but look, we got this, we need to do this, and or we'll use, let's say, Eventbrite, for example. But then across the organization, when you have a bit of amnesty on, well, who are we sharing information with us and why? And this is an actual example with one of the clients that I work with. The organization had 8 different instances of Eventbrite because there's just no organizational control over approving kind of SaaS products, and the Eventbrite module itself, not necessarily saying there's a problem with it. The point I'm actually trying to drive to with Eventbrite is that the fact that they'd been uploading information 8 times to 8 different instances, and there was no central oversight of the organization that anybody else was using it. In that sense, so those are two of the issues I've found with retention. One is, do we actually know where the data is, whether in our systems, or whether we permit software solutions to be used, or whether we're actually aware of the software solutions that we use, where teams may go off and find a bit of software, being told about something, heard about something that they thought would be quite useful to use, and that may well have some benefits, but it's just not necessarily got that oversight. And then the full functionality of, how do we actually start deleting this stuff?
Yeah, and I think it is true that a lot of software providers are still behind the times on this. They are catching up now, but I've had multiple sort of arguments with software providers that we can't delete data out of their systems, and why can't you develop that functionality? I remember when the GDPR first came in, probably around 2019, I had a bit of an argument with Capita themselves over our SIMS database, because they took ages to implement a tool to delete personal data, people data, in line with retention periods. And even when they did, it then had certain conditions that if this box over here was ticked, you couldn't delete it. And it took us about a year to find out what that box was over there. So we had data hanging around, and they just weren't helpful at all. So I've had multiple arguments with them, and the same, the small edtech providers that are essentially just one or two people running a bit of software, they don't have the resources to put into things like this. So EdTech is a whole other area that I could spend another hour going on about. But yeah.
No, for sure. I thought you were actually going to say, and it's something I've come across previously as well, and I'll just share it with you. It's just, especially at the point where the GDPR came in, and shortly afterwards, where some software providers would say, well, we do have something that will make you or ensure that you're complying with your retention schedule, but it's an upgrade that you've got to pay for.
Yeah.
And I've had that several times, and I've had several conversations with organisations that are trying to insist, well, you can become compliant, but you've got to pay for the upgrade, which I've had issues with in the past. Quite helpfully, we're running out of time, but Ben's quite helpfully just moved us on to the one final point we might be able to cover off. And I'm sure there's lots more we could spend a load of time talking about over a range of different things. But helpfully in relation to EdTech and bits and pieces, Ben's mentioned here the need for comprehensive DPIA before implementing systems. And so on and so forth. If you want to unmute and join in and start the conversation on DPIAs, please feel free to do so. Ben, you're more than welcome to, or anybody else on that score. And if not, then we'll just throw the question over to you, Vicky, in relation to DPIAs.
I can do, to the extent of saying they're an absolute pain to get staff to complete them, because they want their nice shiny new system, and this is an extra step which may result in you actually saying it doesn't meet the privacy requirements. So we're getting better, but it always comes down to that resource, and it's not just time to complete it, but having people with knowledge of data protection and trying not to be the DPO completing it yourself, so you can then have that independent sign off.
For sure. And do you have do you get many issues with the DPIA coming to you far too late in the process, and then potentially it's the DPO team that's holding up progress, and we're just seen as a blocker in that sense?
Quite probably. And it's one of my aims this year to try and get some sort of formal governance process in there, where there is a central point in the college where all new systems have to go through. But it's just taking the ability to motivate people to get that in place.
For sure, because it's one thing, I'll just come to you shortly, Vicky. There's one thing that I always get kind of stuck on with organisations where DPIAs come quite late in the day, is it's fine coming late in the day. Yes, we'll still need to run through the DPIA. You've highlighted some really key points there about, well, it maybe doesn't fit privacy or so on and so forth. But doing it late in the day doesn't necessarily mean that the DPIA is would be anywhere reflective of complying with the data protection by design and by default requirements that requires at the very early outset that these things are considered in that sense. So have you found trying to implement any kind of data protection by design and by default difficult within the education sector?
Yes, but I think the best advice I can offer to any DPO working pretty much in any sector is become best friends with the people working in IT. Because unless it's a physical paper-based process, IT is naturally going to get involved fairly early on, especially if it has any sort of technical speak in choosing the system or you need physical servers set up. So where we have done DPIAs, often these have been sidestepped across from IT going, of course we'll help you, but first, can you please speak to the DPO and make sure that the system's okay before we start allocating system engineers to start building the system for you? It's looking at whether those existing processes do exist and who you can get to just champion the need for it in greater depth.
Great bit of advice there as well, Ben. Thank you very much. Just Nadia, you've got your hand up.
Hi there. So what we tend to do is we have a centralized team of our IT data governance, which includes data protection, and our procurement team too. So what we do is we work in a group, which we call the PMO approval process, which includes specific guidance and, you know, processes that have to be completed before any system becomes in place. So by doing that, you've got all the key people who would be aware of any new systems, and then you can catch them before anything happens or gets implemented. So what we've been doing is been working with all of those to make sure that any DPIA that needs to be completed is done. Obviously, sometimes it doesn't happen. A lot of the times we're doing retrospective DPIAs because systems have been in place for quite a long time, but after GDPR came in place. So we're playing catch up in some areas. But with this new process in place, any new systems coming in, what we do is we've got a step check-in function. So you can implement something like that. So like Ben said, you know, getting IT involved is definitely key because they're going to be aware of any new systems. But also if you've got any data managers too, because we need to be aware that if there's any data that's going to be linking to our central servers or our databases sharing data, then we've captured that too. Because what we're finding, and I know Vicky said this a lot, is that sometimes the new systems, they're not deleting the data, but actually what they're doing is they're anonymizing it as well. So if people are releasing pilots of systems, we want to be careful that we are able to remove all the data that we're sharing with people. So if anyone finds that useful.
No, absolutely. It's a great point there, Nadia, and thank you very much for sharing that. And only because you mentioned Vicky, we'll throw over to Vicky as well on this point about DPIAs.
Yeah, I mean, I echo everything that's been said there. They are incredibly hard to get finished. The only thing I would comment is that we actually had one of these processes in place, and quite often or not, it was bypassed by the most senior members of staff. They would say, oh, this new bit of software that's going to benefit the entire school, and it's so amazing and we must do it right now. And they were just not following their own process that they'd signed off themselves, because they thought, we're the top people, if we want this, it's got to be done. So I think it's important to have that process in place, definitely, but it's also important for training, to train everybody who's involved in that process. So your IT, your senior leadership, and to tell them that they have to follow it. And another thing that I was finding as well is that that process was followed, but it was followed very quickly. So they'd sort of begin the process and say, right, in 2 weeks' time, I want this new software in place. So the rest of the process will go tick, 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 really quick. And then it'll come to me and I'll go, right, DPIA, we've got 3 days left to do it. And you can't possibly do it in that time. So it's definitely a good idea to have that process in place. There's just some things you also have to watch out for along the line.
For sure, and I would echo everything that's been said there. I've certainly seen outside of the education sector PMO teams that are designed for the very purpose of the PMO. That's how DP factored into that, which is great to see, and also with procurement teams with DP factored into that area as well, which is great. But then on investigation, you find that the PMO and the procurement team only kicks in over a particular value, and some of the clients I'm thinking of, that's 10-15 grand upwards, and anything under that then is missed by the PMO team and the procurement team, and there's that lower element there. There's a lot of damage you can still do with 10-15 grand prior to and circumventing the whole of the process, not just with the top down and the top down management buying. And likewise, just to finish off, some of the issues I've found with DPIAs as well is, are they necessarily drawing out the full detail when you're looking at a new system, for example, or a new bit of software, and you're getting questions around rights requests and how does the system manage rights requests? I often find on DPAAs, they're simply answered with, well, we've got a policy on that, which is fine if the question was, have you got a policy on rights requests? Not necessarily, how does the system give effect to it? So what we're looking at in that area is, have you asked whoever is behind the system, is it clear from system use whether it's a self-serve function to extract data from it for a SAR purpose, or whether you have to go through the provider, and if you have to go through the provider, what the kind of the SLAs around that and the turnaround times to get that information out of the system under a SAR, or erased fully under an erase request if the erase request is upheld, and so on. I'm sure there's plenty more we could talk about in relation to DPIAs, and I'm sure there's probably lots more we can talk about in relation to how education sector is dealing with data protection compliance issues. Unfortunately, just looking at the time, we have crept past the hour mark, and I do apologise about that. We do try to keep these to an hour in that sense. I hope you found it useful. If there's any other elements around the education sector and data protection generally that you'd like to discuss further, we are more than happy to, with Vicky's support, have a second session on education if you'd find that useful. There is a community that Vicky's leading where we can share ideas, share thoughts, ask questions of each other. That's run through one of our LinkedIn sites. So please do make use of that if you would find there's a kind of a bit of a community to bounce ideas around, bit of a free resource. It's for you to use. It's for you to ask each other questions, that kind of thing. And Vicky will be able to have her input. She feels that she'll be able to support anything in there as well. So please do to make good use of that. Thank you very much for joining us this afternoon, and a great big thank you to Vicky for suggesting that we take this session. And I'd also like to extend a thank you out to Ben, Nadia, Mrs. Lane and Sarah for taking part and muting producing some commentary that we could discuss as part of this forum. I do hope you found it useful, and we look forward to seeing you next week. I've not prepped producer Miles on what's coming up next week. I think it is just a GDPR radio session to end the series. But Miles, if you'd like to pop in.
We're doing 2022 wrapped. So we're basically looking back at our top five most viewed episodes of 2022 and discussing the reasons why we think those episodes were so popular. The reason why they've been viewed so many times, basically.
Good. So I look forward to wrapping up 2022 next week with those who can join us and those who can listen in on our podcast series and who subscribe to listen to us that way. For the time being, all I can say is if you don't join us next week and I don't get a chance to wish you a Merry Christmas beforehand, might still seem a little early on the 9th of December, but still, let me get it in there early. I hope you have a great Christmas and New Year. I do hope you can join us next week. But if not, I look forward to catching up with you all at some point into the new year. Have you got any final thoughts, Vicky?
No, just Merry Christmas, everyone. And I hope you've enjoyed the session. I've very much enjoyed coming on for my first podcast appearance.
Thank you very much. Take care and we'll speak to you soon.